Yes, we should.
Well, I think the argument we need concerns exactly these things.
Which things?
Length and shortness, and excess and deficiency generally. Since the art of measurement, I take it, covers all of these.
Yes.
Let's divide it, then, into two parts, for that's what we need for our present purpose.
Tell me how you divide it.
Like this. One part concerns the mutual relation of largeness and smallness to each other. The other concerns their necessary relation to the coming into being of things.
What do you mean?
Don't you think it's natural to say that the larger must be called larger than nothing except the smaller, and the smaller in turn smaller than the larger, and nothing else?
I do.
But what about this? Won't we also say that whatever exceeds the nature of the moderate, or is exceeded by it, in words or in deeds, really does come about as such, and that it's precisely here that the bad among us differ most from the good?
It appears so.
So we must posit these as two distinct realities and two distinct standards of judging the great and the small, not, as we said just now, only in relation to each other, but rather, as has just been said, one relation to be spoken of as mutual, the other as relative to the moderate. And would you like to learn why?
Of course.
If one lets the nature of the greater be relative to nothing but the lesser, it will never be relative to the moderate. Isn't that so?
Just so.
Then won't we destroy the arts themselves and all their works by this argument, and in particular make vanish both the statesmanship we're now seeking and the weaving we spoke of? For surely all such arts guard against more and less relative to the moderate, not as something that isn't, but as something that is, and hard to manage in practice. And it's by preserving measure in this way that they produce everything good and beautiful.
Of course.
So if we make statesmanship vanish, won't our subsequent search for the kingly science become impassable?
Very much so.
So then, just as in the sophist we forced not being to exist, since our argument escaped us on that point, shouldn't we now likewise force the more and the less to become measurable, not only relative to each other, but also relative to the coming into being of the moderate? For it's simply not possible for anyone to have become, beyond dispute, a statesman or any other expert in matters of action, without this being agreed upon.
Then we should do exactly the same thing now, as much as possible.
This task, Socrates, is even bigger than that one, and yet we remember how long that one was, but it's quite fair to posit something like this about them.
What sort of thing?
That at some point we'll need what's just been said for a precise demonstration about the thing itself, but that it's nicely and adequately shown for our present purposes. That, I think, is a point this argument helps us with magnificently. Namely, that we must hold all the arts alike to be such that greater and lesser are measured not only relative to each other, but also relative to the coming into being of the moderate. For if this exists, those other things exist, and if those exist, this exists too. But if neither of the two existed, neither would ever come to be.
That's right, but what comes after this?
Clearly we should divide the art of measurement, as was said, cutting it in two this way, setting one part as covering all the arts that measure number, lengths, depths, breadths, and speeds relative to their opposites, and the other as covering those that measure relative to the moderate, the fitting, the timely, the needful, and everything else that has settled in the middle, away from the extremes.
And you've named two big divisions, quite different from each other.
Because, Socrates, what many clever people sometimes say, thinking they're stating something wise, namely that the art of measurement covers everything that comes to be, is in fact exactly what's just been said. For in a sense, everything that falls under any art does partake of measurement of some kind. But because people aren't in the habit of examining things by dividing them into kinds, they lump together things that differ this much, thinking them alike right away, and conversely do the opposite of this, failing to divide other things into their parts when what's needed is. Whenever one first perceives the community shared by many things, not to give up before seeing within it all the differences that lie in distinct kinds, and again, when all sorts of dissimilarities are seen among a multitude, not to be able to stop, put off by that, before one has fenced in all the related things within a single likeness, and enclosed them in the being of some one kind. Let this suffice, then, on these matters, and on deficiencies and excesses. Let's just keep in mind that two kinds concerning them have been discovered within the art of measurement, and let's remember what we say they are.
We'll remember.
After this argument, let's take up another one, concerning both the very things we're investigating and the whole practice of discussions of this kind.
What sort of thing?
Suppose someone asked us about the session where learners study their letters. Whenever someone is asked what letters a given word consists of, should we say the question is being asked for the sake of that one word set before him, rather than for the sake of becoming more literate about all the words that might be proposed?
Clearly for the sake of all of them.
Well then, what about our present inquiry concerning the statesman? Has it been proposed for its own sake, rather than for the sake of becoming more skilled in dialectic about everything?
That too is clearly for the sake of everything.
Surely no one with any sense would want to go hunting for the account of weaving itself for its own sake. But I think most people fail to notice that for some things that exist, there are perceptible likenesses readily grasped, which are easy to point out. Whenever someone wants to show them easily, without trouble, to a person who asks for an account of something, apart from any laborious explanation. But for the things that are greatest and most precious, there exists no image wrought clearly for men to see, by pointing to which one could satisfy the soul of the questioner adequately, fitting it to one of the senses. That's why one must practice being able to give and receive an account of each thing. For the things without body, which are the finest and greatest, are shown clearly by reason alone and by nothing else, and it's for the sake of these that everything now being said exists. And practice is easier, on every subject, when dealing with smaller things rather than with greater ones.
Well put.
Let's recall, then, for whose sake all this was said.
For whose sake?
Not least for the sake of this very difficulty, which we accepted, reluctantly, over the long-windedness we allowed regarding weaving, and over the unrolling of the universe, and over the sophist, and the being of not being, noticing how much length these took, and reproaching ourselves over all of it, afraid we might be saying things both superfluous and long, so that we may suffer nothing of the kind again in future, say that all this was said on our part for the sake of exactly this.
So be it, just go on with what comes next.
I say, then, that you and I must keep in mind what's just been said, and on every occasion form our praise and blame of brevity and length in our discussions, not by judging lengths against each other, but by that part of the art of measurement which we said we needed to remember relative to what is fitting.
Right.
Not even relative to that in every respect, for we won't need any length that's fitted to pleasure, except perhaps as a side matter. And as for what's fitted to the search for the thing proposed, so that we might find it as easily and quickly as possible, the argument bids us hold that is secondary, not primary, but far more, and first of all, to honor the method itself of being able to divide by kinds. And indeed, if an account, however immensely long when spoken, makes the hearer better at discovery, we should take that account seriously and not be at all vexed by its length, and likewise if it's shorter. And further still, as for anyone who finds fault with such gatherings for the length of their discussions, and doesn't approve of the circling round in their course, that person shouldn't be let off so quickly and readily, merely blaming what's been said as long, but should also be expected to show, in addition, that if it had been shorter it would have made those present more skilled in dialectic and better at discovering the disclosure of things through reason. And as for any other blame or praise on other, unrelated matters. We shouldn't care about them at all, nor even pretend to listen to such talk. And enough of this, if you agree with me on it too. Let's go back to the statesman, bringing to bear on him the example of weaving as previously described.
Well said, let's do as you say.
Well then, the king has been separated off from the many herding arts, or rather, from all the arts concerned with herds in general. What remains, we say, are the arts within the city itself, both the contributory causes and the actual causes, which we must first divide from one another.
Right.
Do you realize it's hard to cut them in two? The reason, I think, will become no less clear as we go on.
Then we should proceed that way.
Let's divide them limb by limb. Then, like a sacrificial animal, since we can't cut them in two, for one should always cut into the nearest possible number.
How should we proceed now?
Just as before. All the things that supplied instruments for weaving, we set down then, surely, as contributory causes.
Yes.
And now we must do this same thing, only even more so than then. For all the things that produce any instrument, small or great, within the city, must be set down as contributory causes. For without these, there could never be a city nor statesmanship. Yet we surely won't assign any of them as a work of the kingly art.
No, indeed.
And yet we're attempting something hard in separating off this class from the others. For whatever exists among beings, it's plausible enough in saying it's the instrument of some one thing to seem to have said something convincing. Still, let's state this other point about the possessions found in a city.
What point?
That it doesn't have this same capacity. For it isn't fashioned for the sake of causing something to come to be, as an instrument is, but for the sake of preserving what has been made.
What sort of thing do you mean?
Now this, the vessel, worked into every possible shape out of dry and wet materials, with fire or without it, which we address by a single name. That too is a very large class, and I think has nothing whatever to do with the knowledge we're after.
Of course not.
There is a third class of possessions, quite vast, that we must examine. Things that move on land and in water, some wandering about and some fixed in place, some honored and some not, all sharing one name because each exists to be a seat for something, a support that always becomes a resting place for someone.
Which class is that?
We call it the vehicle, hardly the work of statesmanship, but rather very much the business of carpentry, pottery, and bronze working.
I follow.
What of a fourth? Shouldn't we call it distinct from these, the class holding most of the things named long ago? All clothing, most weapons, walls, and every kind of earthen or stone covering, and countless other things besides. Since all of it is made for the sake of defense, it would most justly be called, as a whole, a defense work, and would be considered rather more the product of the builder's and the weaver's arts than of statesmanship.
Certainly.
And should we set down as a fifth class everything to do with ornament and painting, and all the imitations produced with the help of these and of music, made solely for our pleasure, which could rightly be gathered under a single name?
What name?
I think it's called plaything, in some sense.
Of course.
This one name, then, will suit them all when applied, for none of them is done for any serious purpose, but all for the sake of play.
I follow that too, more or less.
And what supplies bodies to all these things, the material out of which, and within which, all the crafts so far named do their work, being itself, in its many varieties, the offspring of many other crafts, shouldn't we set that down as a sixth class?
What exactly do you mean?
Gold and silver, and everything that is mined, and everything that tree-felling and all manner of cutting supply to carpentry and basket-weaving, and further, the stripping of bark from plants, and the tanner's craft that strips the hides from living bodies, and all the crafts concerned with such things, and the makers of cork and papyrus and cordage, which supply the means for producing composite kinds out of things not themselves composite. All this together we call the primary possession of mankind, uncompounded, and in no way the work of the royal science.
Well put.
Now the acquiring of nourishment and everything that mixes into the body, part with part, to serve some bodily function, we should call this, naming it as one whole our nourisher as a seventh class, unless we have something better to call it. And we will more correctly assign the whole of it to farming, hunting, gymnastics, medicine, and cookery than to statesmanship.
Of course.
So then, nearly everything that falls under possession, apart from tame animals, has, I think, been named within these seven kinds. Consider, the primary class was rightly placed first, and after that came instrument, vessel, vehicle, defense work, plaything, and nourisher. Whatever we've left out, if it isn't some major omission, can be fitted into one of these, for instance the class of currency and seals and every kind of stamped mark. For these have no great kindred class of their own among themselves, but some are dragged, forcibly yet fittingly enough, into ornament, others into instruments, and they'll fall into place. As for the possession of tame animals apart from slaves, the herding craft, once divided up, will turn out to have claimed all of that already.
Quite so.
What remains, then, is the class of slaves and of all servants, and among these, I suspect, will find the very people who contest the royal arts weave with the king, just as, back with the weavers, we found those concerned with spinning and carding and all the rest we mentioned. All the others, called joint causes, have been used up along with the tasks just described, and have been separated off from royal and statesmanly activity.
So it seems.
Come, then, let's approach the remaining ones and examine them more closely, so we may know them more securely.
We must.
The greatest servants, as far as we can see from here, we find to have the opposite character from what we suspected as their occupation and condition.
Which ones?
Those bought and acquired in that manner, whom we can call slaves without dispute. They are the last people to lay claim to the royal art.
How could they?
What then of the free men who willingly place themselves in service to the people just named, carrying and exchanging the products of farming and the other crafts between one another, some in the marketplaces, others trading from city to city by sea and by land, bartering currency for goods and currency for currency itself? The ones we've called money changers, merchants, shipowners, and retailers, will they lay any claim to statesmanship?
Perhaps to a share of it, the trading kind at least.
But surely we won't find hired hands and laborers, whom we see serving everyone most readily for pay, ever laying claim to the royal art.
How could they?
What about those who perform such services for us on each occasion?
Which services and which people do you mean?
The tribe of heralds and those who become skilled in writing through frequent service, and various other people terribly clever at working through the business of the magistracies. What shall we call these in turn?
Just what you said, servants, not rulers themselves in the cities.
Well, I certainly wasn't dreaming when I said that those who most seriously contest statesmanship would turn up somewhere in this direction, though it would seem quite strange indeed to look for them in some servant's role.
Quite so.
Let's press on closer still toward those we haven't yet tested. There are those concerned with prophecy who hold some part of a servant's knowledge, for they are regarded as interpreters from the gods to men.
Yes.
And further, the priestly class as well, as custom has it, knows how to give gifts from us to the gods through sacrifices in a manner pleasing to them, and to ask from the gods, through prayers, the acquisition of good things for us, both of these being parts, I think, of a servant's art.
So it appears.
Now at last, we seem to be laying hold of something like the track we've been pursuing. The bearing of priests and prophets is filled with great pride, and they win a solemn reputation because of the magnitude of their undertakings, so much so that in Egypt no king may rule without also holding priestly office. And if it happens that someone from another class seizes power by force first, he must afterward be initiated into that priestly class. And among the Greeks too, in many places, one would find the greatest offices assigned the duty of performing the greatest of such sacrifices. And indeed among you here it is especially clear what I mean. For they say that to the man chosen by lot as king here are assigned the most solemn and most ancestral of the old sacrifices.
Quite so.
These kings chosen by lot, then together with their priesthood and their servants, and yet another very large crowd, which has now become clear to us once the earlier groups have been set aside, must be examined.
Whom do you mean?
A rather strange lot indeed.
How so?
A thoroughly mixed breed, as it now appears on inspection. Many of these men resemble lions and centaurs and other such creatures, and a great many more resemble satyrs and the weak, shifting kind of beasts. They quickly exchange their shapes and their powers with one another. And now, Socrates, I think I've just recognized who these men are.
Tell me then, you seem to have spotted something strange.
Yes, strangeness always comes from ignorance for everyone. And that's exactly what happened to me just now. I was suddenly at a loss when I caught sight of the chorus concerned with the affairs of cities.
Which chorus?
The greatest sorcerer of all the sophists, and the most experienced in this art. A man we must strip away from the true statesmen and kings, difficult as that is, if we are to see clearly what we're after.
Well, that's certainly not something to let go of.
No, indeed, not as far as I'm concerned. Now tell me this.
What?
Isn't rule by a single man one of our forms of political rule?
Yes.
And after monarchy, I suppose one would name rule by the few.
Of course.
And isn't a third form of constitution the rule of the multitude, called by the name democracy?
Certainly.
And though there are three, don't they in a sense become five, each of the first two giving birth to a further pair of names alongside its own?
Which ones?
Looking now to force and consent, and to poverty and wealth, and to law and lawlessness arising within them, people split each of the two into a pair and call monarchy, since it presents two forms under two names, tyranny in one case and kingship in the other.
Of course.
And the city mastered by the few at any time, they call aristocracy and oligarchy.
Quite so.
As for democracy, whether the multitude rules over those who hold property by force or by consent, and whether it guards the laws strictly or not, in every case no one is accustomed to change its name.
True.
Well then, do we suppose any of these constitutions could be correct, defined by these boundaries, by one man, by the few, or by the many, by wealth or poverty, by force or consent, with written laws or without them?
What's to prevent it?
Look more closely, following me this way.
Which way?
Shall we hold fast to what was said at the very start, or depart from it?
What was that?
We said, I believe, that the royal rule is one of the sciences.
Yes.
And not just any of the sciences, but we selected out from the rest a certain judging and directing kind.
Yes.
And from the directing kind, one part concerned with lifeless works, another with living creatures, and dividing things this way, we've kept advancing to this point, never losing sight of the science itself, though we still haven't been able to pin down exactly which one it is.
You're right.
Do we then grasp this very point, that the defining mark must not be the few or the many, nor the willing or the unwilling, nor poverty or wealth, but some form of knowledge if we're to follow what's gone before.
Well, that's certainly impossible to avoid.
So now, of necessity, we must consider in which of these arrangements knowledge concerning the rule of men, the acquisition of what is perhaps the most difficult and greatest of all things, turns out actually to occur. For we must see it clearly, so we may observe which people must be stripped away from the wise king, people who pretend to be statesmen and persuade many, yet are nothing of the sort.
Yes, we must do that, as our argument has already told us.
Does it seem possible, then, that the multitude in a city could acquire this science?
How could they?
But could it be possible in a city of 1,000 men for some 100, or even 50, to acquire it adequately?
That would make it the easiest of all skills. We know that 1,000 men who are top-notch at drafts would never measure up to the true experts found among the rest of the Greeks, let alone kings. Anyone who possesses the kingly knowledge, whether he actually rules or not, must still be called kingly, by the argument we gave before.
Well remembered. And I think it follows that we must look for correct rule in the case of one person, or two, or in general very few, whenever it really is correct.
Of course.
And these rulers, whether they govern willing or unwilling subjects, whether by written law or without it, whether they are rich or poor, we must reckon them, just as we do now, as ruling by virtue of some skill, whatever it may be. Take doctors. We don't hesitate to call them doctors whether they heal us willingly or against our will, whether by cutting, cauterizing, or inflicting some other pain, whether they follow written rules or not, whether they are poor or rich, we call them doctors all the same. So long as they exercise authority through their skill, purging or otherwise reducing or building up the body, provided it is for the body's good, making it better instead of worse, and so long as those who treat their patients preserve them. This, I think, and no other standard, is the correct one for medicine and for any other form of rule.
Quite so.
Then it must follow that among constitutions, too, this one alone is correct. And genuinely a constitution the one in which the rulers can be found to possess real knowledge, not merely the appearance of it, whether they rule by law or without law, over willing or unwilling subjects, whether they are poor or rich. None of this should count for anything, on any correct reckoning.
Well put.
And whether they purify the city for its good by killing some citizens or banishing them, or make it smaller by sending out colonies somewhere like swarms of bees, or make it larger by bringing in outsiders, and turning them into citizens so long as they act with knowledge and justice, preserving it, and making it better rather than worse to the extent they can. This, and this alone, by such standards, must be called the one correct constitution. All the others we speak of must be said to be not genuine, not real constitutions at all. But imitations of this one, the ones we call well-ordered, are imitating it toward what is finer, the others toward what is more shameful.
The rest of what you've said, stranger, seems reasonable enough. But that rulers should govern even without laws, that was harder to accept.
You've beaten me to the question by a hair, Socrates. I was about to ask you whether you accepted everything, or whether something in what was said troubled you. But now it's clear. We will want to work through this business of the correctness of rulers who govern without laws.
Of course.
In a way, obviously, lawmaking belongs to the kingly art. But the best thing is not for the laws to hold power, but for a man who is kingly and possesses practical wisdom to hold it. Do you see why?
Why do you say that?
Because law could never, by grasping accurately at once what is best and most just for everyone, prescribe the single best course. For the dissimilarities among people and their actions, and the fact that almost nothing in human affairs ever stays still, prevent any skill whatsoever from making any simple pronouncement that holds for everything, for all time. We agree on that, don't we?
Certainly.
But we see that law aims at pretty much exactly This simplicity, like some stubborn, ignorant person who lets nobody do anything contrary to his own ruling, and won't allow anyone even to ask a question, not even if something new turns out to be better for someone, contrary to the rule he himself laid down.
True, that's exactly how the law treats each of us, without exception.
So isn't it impossible for something that is always simple to fit well with things that are never simple?
It seems likely.
Then why on earth is it necessary to make laws at all, since law is not the most correct thing? We must find the reason for this.
Indeed.
Now, don't you have, among you as in other cities, group training sessions for running or something else for the sake of competition?
Plenty of them, yes.
Come, let's recall again from memory the instructions given by skilled trainers in charge of such exercises.
What sort of thing?
That they don't think it feasible to work in fine detail with each individual, prescribing what suits each particular body. They think they must lay down a somewhat coarser regimen, one that fits the majority of bodies and applies to many people at once.
Well put.
That's exactly why, assigning equal exertions to them all together, they start them off together and stop them together, in running, wrestling, and every bodily exercise.
That's so.
Then let's suppose that the lawgiver, too, who must oversee the herds in matters of justice and their mutual dealings, will never be capable of giving, to everyone all together, an exact prescription of what is fitting for each individual.
That's likely, at any rate.
No, I think he will lay down the law for the majority, in a rough and general way, for each case, whether he sets it down in writing or leaves it unwritten, legislating according to ancestral custom.
Right.
Right indeed. For how could anyone ever manage, Socrates, to sit beside each person for his whole life and prescribe with precision what is fitting for him? Since if any one of those who truly possess the kingly knowledge were capable of that, he would hardly go and burden himself, I think, by writing down these so-called laws.
At least from what has just been said, stranger, that follows.
And even more so, my good fellow, from what is about to be said.
Such as?
Something like this. Let's put it to ourselves this way. Suppose a doctor, or perhaps a trainer, is about to go abroad and expects to be away from his patients for a good long time, thinking his instructions might be forgotten by those in training or under treatment. Wouldn't he want to write down notes for them?
He would.
But what if he came back sooner than expected? Wouldn't he dare to prescribe something different from those written notes, if conditions changed for the better for the patients because of winds or some other factor sent by Zeus, turning out differently from what was usual? Would he really insist on sticking rigidly to what was laid down long ago, refusing either to prescribe anything else himself or to let the patient dare anything else contrary to what was written, on the grounds that this alone is medically sound and healthy, and anything done otherwise is diseased and unskilled? Wouldn't such a thing, occurring within genuine knowledge and true skill applied to everything, become the biggest joke of all such legislating?
Absolutely it would.
And take the man who has written down, in law both written and unwritten, what is just and unjust, noble and shameful, good and bad, for the human herds that graze city by city under the laws of those who wrote them. If the very lawgiver who wrote with skill, or someone else just like him, should arrive, would he be forbidden from prescribing anything different from this? Wouldn't that prohibition, too, look every bit as ridiculous as the other one in truth?
Certainly.
Do you know what most people say on this point?
I can't think of it right now.
And it sounds plausible enough. They say that if someone knows of laws better than those handed down by earlier generations, he ought to make law for his own city only after persuading it, and not otherwise.
Well, isn't that right?
Perhaps, But suppose someone, instead of persuading, forces through the better course, tell me, what will we call this kind of force? Not yet, though answer first about the earlier case.
Which one do you mean?
Suppose someone with correct medical skill, without persuading the patient, forces the better treatment on a child, a man, or a woman, contrary to what is written, what will we call this kind of force? Anything sooner than calling it the diseased error contrary to skill? And isn't it right for the one forced to say anything about what happened to him, except that he suffered something diseased and unskillful at the hands of the doctors who forced him?
Perfectly true.
And what do we call the error that goes against the political skill? Isn't it what's shameful, bad, and unjust?
Absolutely.
So take those who have been forced to do things contrary to the written and ancestral rules, things that are actually more just, better, and finer than what came before. Tell me, if we're to avoid being the most laughable people of all, must we not say anything sooner than that those who were forced by the ones who forced them suffered something shameful, unjust, and bad?
Perfectly true.
But is it really the case that if the one applying force is rich, what was forced is just, while if he's poor, it's unjust? Or rather, whether he persuades or doesn't persuade, whether rich or poor, whether by written law or against it, whether he acts to our advantage or not, shouldn't the truest standard for the correct management of a city be this, that the wise and good man will manage the affairs of those he rules? Just as the ship's captain, always watching out for what benefits the vessel and the crew, saves his fellow sailors not by writing rules, but by offering his skill as law in just this same way, wouldn't a correct constitution arise from those capable of ruling like this, since they offer the strength of their skill as something stronger than the laws? And is there any error at all in whatever these wise rulers do, so long as they safeguard one great thing, always distributing what is most just to the people in the city, using intelligence and skill, and are able thereby to preserve them and to make them better instead of worse, as far as possible?
There's no arguing with what's just been said.
And indeed, there's no arguing with the other point either.
Which point was that?
That no multitude whatsoever, having acquired this kind of knowledge, could ever be capable of governing a city with intelligence. Rather, we must look for that one correct constitution around some small number, or few, or a single person, and we must treat all the others as imitations, as we said a little earlier, some imitating it toward what is finer, others toward what is more shameful.
What do you mean by that? I didn't quite grasp the point about imitations just now either.
And yet it's no small matter if someone stirs up this line of thought and then drops it without following it through, without showing the error that now occurs concerning it.
What error do you mean?
We must look into something not altogether familiar or easy to see. Still, let's try to grasp it. Given that this constitution we've described is the only correct one, you understand that the others must survive by using its written codes, doing what is now praised, even though it isn't the most correct thing.
What do you mean?
That no one in the city should dare to act contrary to the laws, and whoever dares should be punished with death and every extreme penalty. And this is the most correct and finest arrangement, as a second best, once someone has set aside the first option we just described. Let's work out how this thing we called second best came to be, shall we?
By all means.
Let's go back again to the images we must always use to compare kingly rulers to.
What images?
The noble ship's captain and the doctor who is worth many others. Let's examine a certain figure by shaping it out of these very examples.
What kind of figure?
Something like this. Suppose we all decided that doctors and sea captains treat us in the most terrible way. Whichever of us either of them wants to save, they save well enough, but whichever they want to injure, they injure, cutting and burning and ordering us to bring them payments as though they were taxes, of which they spend little or nothing on the actual patient, while they and their households enjoy the rest. and in the end, taking money from the patient's relatives or enemies as a fee, they kill him. As for the captains, they do countless other things of the same kind, deliberately abandoning people ashore when they put out to sea, engineering wrecks out on open water and throwing people overboard, and other villainies besides. Suppose, then, that having thought all this through, we resolve to take some action about them. No longer to let either art govern with unchecked authority, whether over slave or free, but to convene an assembly of ourselves, either the whole people or just the wealthy, and let it be open to laymen and to practitioners of other crafts, as well to contribute their opinion about seafaring and about diseases, on how we ought to use drugs and medical instruments on patients, and likewise ships themselves and nautical gear for the use of ships, and about the dangers involved. Both those from winds and sea that belong to the voyage itself, and those from encounters with pirates, and should it come to it, see battles fought with warships against other warships. And whatever the majority decides about these matters, whether on the advice of doctors and captains or of other laymen, let it be written up on tablets and pillars, and let some things be laid down as unwritten ancestral customs. And let all sailing be conducted according to these rules from now to the end of time, and all treatment of the sick as well.
What you've described is thoroughly absurd.
And then, year by year, let officers be appointed from the people, whether from the wealthy or from the whole populace, chosen by lot, whoever draws the lot. And let the officers so appointed govern by the written rules, piloting the ships and healing the sick.
This is even harder to accept.
Then look at what follows from this. Once each officer's year is up, we'll need to convene courts, made up of men either pre-selected from the wealthy, or again, chosen by lot from the whole populace, and bring the outgoing officers before them to be audited. And let anyone who wishes bring the charge that during his year, an officer did not pilot the ships according to the writings, nor according to the ancient customs of our forefathers, and the same for those who treated the sick. And whoever is convicted, let the court assess what penalty they should suffer, or what fine they should pay.
Well, surely anyone who chooses of his own free will to hold office under such conditions deserves whatever penalty or fine he gets, most justly.
And beyond all this, we'll still need to pass a law that if anyone is found investigating the truth of piloting and seafaring, or of health and medicine, concerning winds and hot and cold, apart from the written rules, and being clever about such things in any way first, he must not be called a doctor or a pilot at all, but a stargazer, some babbling sophist. And then, on the ground that he is corrupting others, younger men, and persuading them to take up piloting or medicine unlawfully, setting themselves up as unchecked authorities over ships and the sick, anyone who is entitled to may indict him and bring him before some court. And if he's judged to be persuading people, young or old, contrary to the laws and the written rules, let him be punished with the harshest penalties. For nothing, they'll say, should be wiser than the laws. Nobody is ignorant of medicine and health, or of piloting and seafaring, since it's open to anyone who wishes to learn the written rules and the established ancestral customs. Now, Socrates, if this were how things stood, for these sciences, and for generalship too, and for every kind of hunting whatever, and for painting, or any branch of imitative art, and for carpentry, and for the making of every sort of implement, and for farming and the whole art concerned with plants, or if we were to see some art of horse breeding conducted this way, by the book, or the whole art of herding, or divination, or every part covered by the servants' arts, or board games, or the whole of arithmetic taken purely by itself, whether in plain figures or solids or rates of change, what would all this look like if it were practiced according to writings and not according to skill?
Clearly all the arts would be utterly destroyed for us and could never even come into being again afterward because of this law forbidding inquiry, so that life, hard enough as it is now, would become entirely unlivable in that future time.
What about this, then? Suppose we forced each of the people mentioned to act according to the writings, and to have the man elected by show of hands, or chosen by Lart's chance, oversee our writings. But he, caring nothing for the writings, tried, out of some profit or personal favor, to do something else against them, though he understood nothing. Wouldn't this become an even greater evil than the one before?
Absolutely true.
Because, I think, when someone dares to act against laws laid down out of long experience, with advisers who gave their counsel graciously on each point, and persuaded the people to adopt them, the transgressor, in producing a mistake many times over the size of the original one, overturns every course of action still more than the writings themselves did.
Of course he does.
For this reason, then, for those who lay down laws and writings about anything at all, the second best course is never, ever to let one person or the multitude do anything at all contrary to these.
Right.
So wouldn't these, in each case, be imitations of the truth, things written down, as far as possible, by those who know?
Of course.
And yet we said that the one who knows, the true statesman, if we remember, will do many things by his art in the conduct of his own business, caring nothing for the writings, whenever something else seems to him better than what he himself wrote and prescribed to people who are absent.
Yes, we said that.
So then, whatever single man or whatever multitude, bound by established laws, attempts to do anything contrary to them on the grounds that it is better, does the same thing, as far as it can, as that true statesman.
Quite so.
Now if they do this without knowledge, they would be attempting to imitate the true thing, but they'd imitate it very badly. Whereas if they have the skill, this is no longer imitation at all, but that truest thing itself.
Entirely so.
And yet we have already agreed, earlier, that no multitude whatsoever is capable of acquiring any art.
Yes, we've agreed to that.
So if there really is a kingly art, then the mass of the wealthy and the whole populace could never acquire this political science.
How could they?
So it seems that such constitutions, if they mean to imitate as well as they can that true constitution, the one ruled by a single person with skill, must never, once their laws are established, do anything contrary to what is written and to ancestral custom.
Beautifully put.
So whenever the wealthy imitate this, we call that kind of constitution aristocracy. But whenever they pay no heed to the laws, oligarchy.
So it seems.
And again, whenever one person rules according to laws, imitating the one who has knowledge, we call him king, not distinguishing by name between the one who reigns alone by law with knowledge and the one who reigns by mere opinion.
It seems so.
So then, if someone who truly has knowledge rules alone, he will certainly be given this very same name, king, and nothing else, which is why the five names now given to constitutions have become just one.
So it appears.
But what about when a single ruler acts neither according to laws nor according to customs, but pretends, like the one with knowledge, that the best course must be taken even against what's written, while in fact some desire and ignorance is what's really guiding this imitation? Shouldn't we then call each such person a tyrant?
Of course.
This, then, is how tyrant and king have come about, and oligarchy and aristocracy and democracy, because people were disgusted with that single monarch and refused to believe that anyone could ever become worthy of such rule, someone both willing and able to rule with virtue and knowledge, distributing what is just and holy correctly to everyone, and instead believed he would injure and kill and harm whichever of us he wished at any moment. Since if such a ruler as we describe did come to be, he would be loved and would govern happily, steering with precision the one and only correct constitution.
Of course.
But as things actually stand, since no king of the sort that arises in beehives is born in our cities, One man distinguished at once in body and in soul. People have to come together and write laws, it seems, chasing after the footprints of the truest constitution.
So it seems.
Should we be surprised, then, Socrates, at all the evils that occur and will occur in such constitutions, given that this is the foundation laid under them, acting according to writings and customs without knowledge? Anyone who used a different foundation would make it perfectly obvious that everything built on it would collapse. Or should we marvel instead at how strong a city is by nature? For cities have been enduring things like this for an endless span of time, and yet some of them remain stable and are not overturned, though many, to be sure, sink and perish like ships, have already perished, and will go on perishing because of the wickedness of their captains and crews, people who have taken on the greatest ignorance about the greatest matters, who, understanding nothing whatsoever about politics, believe they have acquired the clearest knowledge of all sciences on every point.
Very true.
So then, of these incorrect constitutions, which is least harsh to live under, given that all of them are harsh, and which is the most burdensome? Is this something we ought to examine, even though it's said in passing relative to our present subject? Still, perhaps everything we do is ultimately for the sake of just such a question.
We must, of course.
Then say that the same one, out of the three, turns out to be by far the harshest, and also the easiest.
What do you mean?
Nothing other than this. I mean that rule by one, rule by the few, and rule by the many are the three we named at the outset of the argument, now flowing along.
Yes, they were.
Then let's cut each of these in two, and make six out of the three, setting the correct one apart from them as a seventh.
How so?
Out of monarchy, kingship, and tyranny, out of rule by the few, we said, the well-named one, aristocracy and oligarchy, and out of rule by the many, what we then called by the single name democracy. But now we must treat this one too as double.
How so, and on what basis do we divide it?
On no different basis than the others, even if its name has always been single so far. Still, ruling according to law and ruling contrary to law apply to this one too, as to the others.
Yes, they do.
Now, when we were looking for the correct constitution, this division was of no use, as we showed earlier. But once we set that one apart and laid down the others as necessary alternatives, then, within these, the lawful and the unlawful divide each of them in two.
So it appears, now that this argument has been stated.
Well then, monarchy yoked to good writings, what we call laws, is the best of all six. But lawless monarchy is harsh, and the hardest of all to live under.
It looks that way.
And the rule of the not many, like the small number that stands midway between one and the multitude, let us set down as a mean between the two extremes in both directions. While the rule of the multitude is in every way weak and capable of nothing very great, whether good or bad, compared with the others, because in it the offices of power are parcelled out in small shares among many people. That is why, of all these constitutions when they are lawful, it is the worst, but when all of them are lawless, it is the best. And if all are undisciplined, life in a democracy wins out, but if all are orderly, it is the least livable of the three. While under the first kind of rule life is by far the best and finest, except for the seventh. For that one must be set apart from all the others, like a guard set apart from men.
It certainly appears that things fall out this way, and we should proceed just as you say.
Then must we not also strip away from all these constitutions, except the one grounded in knowledge, the people who share in them, on the ground that they are not statesmen at all but faction-mongers, and that being champions of the greatest phantom images, they are themselves phantoms of the same kind, and being the greatest imitators and enchanters, they turn out to be the greatest sophists among sophists.
It looks as though the term has, quite rightly, come round full circle onto the very people who are called statesmen.
Well then, This part of our business, as we said just now, appears to be like a drama, a troupe of centaurs and satyrs, so to speak, which had to be separated out from the art of statesmanship, and now, with great difficulty, it has been separated.
So it appears.
But there remains another part, still more difficult, because it is more akin to and more closely bound up with the kingly kind, and harder to make out clearly. And it seems to me we are in much the same position as those who refine gold.
How so?
Those craftsmen first separate out earth and stones, and a good many other foreign things, and after that there remain, mixed in together, the precious things akin to gold, which can only be removed by fire, copper and silver, and sometimes even adamant, which, hardly separated out by testing in the smelting, at last let us see the so-called pure gold all by itself, alone.
Yes, that is indeed said to be how it happens.
By the same reasoning, then, it seems that now too the other things, all that is foreign and unrelated to the science of statesmanship, have been separated off from it, and what remains are the precious and kindred things. Among these, I think, are generalship, the administration of justice, and whatever rhetoric shares in kingship by persuading toward justice and helps steer the business of cities. By what method could one most easily set these apart and show, naked and alone, that very thing we have been searching for?
Clearly, we must try to do exactly that.
For the sake of the attempt, then, it will come into view, but we must try to reveal it by way of music. Now tell me.
What?
There is, I take it, some branch of learning we call music, and in general among the sciences having to do with craftsmanship.
There is.
Well then, as to whether we ought to learn any one of these or not, shall we say this too is itself some science concerned with just that question, or how?
Yes, we shall say it is.
And shall we agree that this science is different from those others?
Yes.
And is it right that none of them should rule any other, or that those others should rule this one, or that this one, exercising oversight, should rule all the rest?
This one should rule those others.
So you declare that the science which decides whether we ought to learn something or not must rule over the science that is learned and that teaches?
Absolutely.
And likewise the science that decides whether one ought to persuade or not must rule over the science capable of persuading?
Of course.
Well then, to which science shall we assign the power of persuasion over the mass and the crowd, exercised through storytelling rather than through teaching?
That, I think, is clearly to be given to rhetoric.
And whether one ought to act toward certain people through persuasion or through some kind of force, or to keep entirely still, to which science shall we assign this in turn?
To the science that rules over the arts of persuasion and speech.
And that would be none other, I think, than the power of the statesman.
Very well put.
And this too seems to have been quickly separated from statesmanship, rhetoric, as a distinct kind, though it serves statesmanship.
Yes.
And what are we to think about this other power in turn?
Which one?
The power that decides how one ought to wage war against whatever enemies we have chosen to fight. Shall we call this itself an art or not?
How could we think it lacks art, when generalship and the whole practice of war carry it out?
And the science able to deliberate about whether one ought to go to war or come to terms through friendship, shall we take this to be different from that one, or the same?
Given what we have already accepted, it must be different.
Then shall we declare that this one rules over the other, if indeed we are to hold consistently to what we accepted before?
I agree.
Then whom shall we ever attempt to declare the master of this whole formidable and mighty art of war, except the one who is truly kingly?
No one else.
So we shall not set down the science of generals as statesmanship, since it is merely a servant.
That seems unlikely.
Come then, let us also examine the power of judges, who judge rightly.
By all means.
Does it, then, have any greater power than this, taking over, with respect to contracts, all the lawful rules laid down by a lawgiver king, and judging by looking to these what has been ordained as just and unjust, contributing its own particular virtue of never being swayed by bribes, fears, pity, or any other enmity or friendship, so as to be willing to decide people's mutual charges against each other contrary to the lawgiver's ordinance?
No, pretty much what you have said is the whole work of this power.
Then we find the strength of judges to be, not kingly rule, but the guardian and servant of the laws.
So it seems.
This much we must grasp, looking over all the sciences we have named together. None of them has turned out to be statesmanship. For the one that is truly kingly ought not to act itself, but to rule over those capable of acting, knowing the right beginning and impulse for the most important matters in cities as to timeliness and untimeliness, while the others carry out what is assigned to them.
Rightly said.
For this reason, then, the sciences we have just gone through, ruling neither one another nor themselves, but each concerned with some private business of its own, have rightly taken a name proper to the particular nature of its own business.